And welcome to Talking History. And today in our studios, we have Mark Klempner, the author of The Heart Has Reasons, Holocaust Rescuers and Their Stories of Courage. Mark, welcome.
Thank you, Jerry.
Mark, I like to start by asking people about what led them to write the books that they wrote. And could you basically tell us what you are a folklorist, you're an oral historian, and here you're focusing on a number of individuals in Holland who really took their lives into their own hands, took risks to save Jewish children. And what led you to this topic in the first place?
Well, sometimes we do things and we don't fully understand at the time why we did them. That was the case with me. It was started out in a very trivial way where I was an undergraduate at Cornell, returning to school student, and I saw a poster that said research grants to do research in Europe, and there was an application date they were due in about a week, and I thought, oh, I've never been to Europe, I'd like to go. So then when I began to apply for this grant, I had to think about what I was going to research, and that's when this deeper level came in, which is that my father was on the last boat out of Poland before the Nazis invaded, and all the relatives left behind perished except for one uncle. And so basically I grew up in the shadow of the Holocaust, and I always had this attraction and repulsion. I wanted to know more about it, but I also was really afraid of it, because growing up in my family, it was a wound without memory for me. It wasn't spoken of, but you felt the trauma in the silences. So I always wanted to kind of deal with that somehow. And I began to think, well, if I interview Holocaust rescuers, they would have been the only hope if my father hadn't been able to get out of Poland, because he was a child at the time, and his only hope would have been somebody who would have taken in a Jewish child. So I went, and that became my project, interviewing Dutch people who rescued Jewish children. And then I can anticipate your next question. Why Dutch people? Why not
precisely
Polish people? Excuse me for doing your job.
Oh, but I love when my guests do my job.
Well, there's another case of my not fully knowing why I did what I did. Because what I realized later was that it would have been just too heavy to go to Poland. Considering my fear level, to go to the country where all my relatives were hunted down and shot, killed, burned, just would have been too much for me. This was partly about me getting over my own fears. So I think that's why I chose these people who weren't afraid at that time. They were the people who had enough courage that they were able to reach out and help their neighbors. So it was kind of a back door for me into the Holocaust. And then another thing I didn't realize when I just made this simple decision to try and get a free trip to Europe is that I was kind of hankering for an antidote to my 10 years in L.A. as a studio musician. Before I went back to school, actually, I didn't go back to school. I'd never been to college. I'd been playing music from the age of 15. And I wound up in L.A. I was in the Hollywood scene. And I got really sick of all the self-aggrandizement and me first and everybody wanting riches and fame. And unconsciously, I was kind of longing for an antidote. And partly, going to college was exposing me to great literature and all kinds of wonderful things. And that was a whole lot better to me than what I'd been in L.A. But meeting the rescuers was just so powerful, because these people are the exact opposite of that kind of materialism and me-first attitudes that were prevalent in L.A. And that had a huge impact on me.
Before we get into the stories that you tell, in the book. I want you to tell us a little bit about, put Holland in perspective. I mean, you took this trip, you did this research, you went to this place. How does Holland compare to other Western and Eastern European countries in terms of what happened to the Jews in that particular nation?
Well, that's another case where, you know, I thought Holland would be, quote, lighter than Poland. But in fact, what I soon learned was that it was just as bad a situation, almost as bad. Not quite as bad, because the Poles were anti-Semitic in general, while the Dutch were not. But Holland had the worst survival rate of any country in Western Europe, worse than Belgium, worse than France. And a number of factors combined to really, really make it a terrible place for Jews to have been during the Nazi occupation.
Yeah, I was reading the introduction where you give a lot of the statistics, and you note that between 11% and 30% of Jews in Holland were able to survive. And what about in Eastern Europe? I take it it's lower numbers.
No, it was about the same. No, maybe 10% really? Of Jews survived.
Oh,
in Poland, so that would be about the same as the.
As the low number for for the Netherlands.
Exactly. Yeah. So, just to explain why the number was so low, I think it was a combination of several things. You know, I talk about the perfect storm. It was like a perfect hurricane of bad factors. The Dutch have a lot of respect for authority. They're a very well-ordered society. And they just were not up to suddenly becoming defiant, rebellious when the Nazis took them over. They're a small country. They're used to negotiating with larger, more powerful countries. They're used to accommodating other countries by learning their languages. So the Dutch, when the Nazis occupied the Netherlands, the Dutch tended to go along with what they wanted, especially because in the beginning they were very polite and they were civil and they didn't seem to be doing anything that bad. So they got off on this foot with the Nazis of cooperating. Furthermore, the Nazis were very covert about their plans, even though stories had filtered from Germany about Kristallnacht and so forth. The Nazis, as I said, seemed very courteous and didn't come out with their agenda immediately, but step by step by step by step.
Yeah, you described the process as to denigrate, to isolate, to deport, and to kill. Is that the pattern that was followed in every one of the European states?
Yeah, that was the basic pattern. And in the Netherlands, the Nazis, as one survivor put it, used the salami technique. Just slicing it, slicing it, slicing it, until they had something they could just easily manage.
So you went out to Holland and you started interviewing people. How did you identify the folks that you wanted to interview?
Well, from a historical perspective, my work was done for me in advance, because all of these people had been awarded the Yad Vashem honor. And Yad Vashem has a whole team of historians that carefully scrutinize all the testimony. They require two eyewitnesses and so forth. So these people had all gone through that process with Yad Vashem in Israel.
Could you explain what Yad Vashem is to our listeners who may not know?
Yad Vashem is an official agency of the State of Israel that has made it their mission to identify people who helped the Jews during the Nazi years. And then they give them a medal, they fly them to Israel, and they formally honor them.
And they also keep a record of all of the...
They do. They have a wall of the righteous where they inscribe their name on a marble wall, and they have the garden of the righteous with trees that they plant in the name of the righteous. Mm-hmm.
And do they have a record of those who were killed, too.
They do. They do.
So in Holland, so they had basically a record of the rescuers. And how did you decide on which ones to interview?
Well, I wrote them a letter, which I had translated.
How many were there, by the way, that you were able to identify at Yad Vashem?
About 70 or 80 living rescuers living in Holland. And I wrote them a letter, and I explained what I wanted to do, and I got back 40 positive replies. So about half of the people I wrote to wanted to talk to me, or were willing to talk to me. And those were the people that I interviewed.
So tell us about the folks that you interviewed. First of all, you wrote them the initial letter, and did you followed up with additional correspondence, or did you contact them by phone, or did you?
No, the cultural director at the Israeli embassy in The Hague mailed the letter for me. They kept their addresses private. And then I didn't know until I landed in the Netherlands how many had given me an affirmative response.
Ah.
So okay. I immediately met with her, and she told me that 40 people had said that they would be willing to talk with me, and then she gave me their phone numbers and names.
Okay. So you went through the list then systematically?
Mm-hmm.
So tell me what they, when you approached them, what they said to you.
Well, it was overwhelming. They were incredible. They were, I basically do one person a day, and typically I'd spend the whole day with that person. Once I had a preliminary phone interview, just to make sure that they spoke enough English and so forth, I didn't have much Dutch, so I really needed them to be able to speak to me in English. And I would get up early in the morning, get on the train, find their house, knock on the door, and they would welcome me in, and we would spend all day talking. They would give me breakfast, lunch, dinner. Sometimes they'd ask me if I wanted to spend the night. It was kind of an intensive immersion into the culture of these people, which is a very, very wonderful culture of kindness, generosity. And I was quite overwhelmed by that.
Were there any characteristics that the 40 had in common that you could, after you completed these interviews, before we get into the individual stories of these 40 individuals, or actually 10, because your book focuses on 10 of the 40. But what are there characteristics that you can sort of summarize that they would have in common?
Well, as I said, first of all, what struck me about them was their kindness. They would say, oh, it's late, why don't you stay for dinner? And you don't want to take the train back to Amsterdam at this hour, why don't you, we have a guest bedroom, you're welcome to stay over. They were just so kind. And I mean, I was a total stranger. And they made me feel like I was some long-lost member of their family. They also were clearly people who have been activists all their lives. Right away I realized that this wasn't just about what they did back then, but they were telling me about what they were doing, you know, now. And I realized that I wanted to include that in the book, because I thought it was fascinating that they were, you know, involved with, you know, the sanctuary movement, taking in refugees from Africa, you know, writing letters on behalf of people who were unjustly imprisoned, collecting clothes to send to Romania for the people who have to face a cold winter without adequate clothes. So that struck me about them, that they were still active.
That activism, is it something that was derived from their actions during World War II, or were they activists even before they made the decision to take the risk of becoming rescuers?
Well, that's a really good question, Jerry, and I pondered that when I was writing The Heart Has Reasons. And I think it's a combination of both. I think that they had that seed in them, and then the war gave them a decision to make, and they decided to go for it. they decided, when placed in that crucible, that moral crucible of the war, so many people just wanted to dive out of it and live a safe life, as safe as they could live during the Nazi occupation. But the rescuers just rose to the moral challenge, and they just could stand the heat, and they decided to start helping those people who were targeted for annihilation. And I think that that caused that qualities in them, those altruistic qualities, that really caused them to become strong, and I think that molded the rest of their lives.
These folks you've interviewed, I'm still intrigued by you pointing out their activism and their commitment to social justice. And I'm intrigued because going back to my first question, what is it that they had in common? Did they belong to politically active organizations in the 30s in Holland? Were they members of left-wing parties? Did they have religious commitments that help explain the type of moral actions they took? Were they intellectuals? Were they working class? I mean, thinking sociologically as a historian, I tend to start before I even get into the, actually it's not even before, but as I collect or as I listen to individual stories, I also think of the collective.
In the people that I interviewed, surprisingly, only one was really politically oriented. He had heard about, he had been very aware of what Hitler was up to. He had read the propaganda, and he had been in a political group that was opposed to fascism. And when the Nazis occupied the country, he knew it was coming, and he formed a little student group. He was a student at the University of Amsterdam. He formed a student group dedicated to taking some kind of political action or actually engaging in sabotage. But what happened was he was approached by another group in Utrecht, and they said, you're sitting in Amsterdam where all these Jewish people are, because that was where the Jewish people were concentrated, and they need to hide while we're in Utrecht, and we know of hiding places for them. Could you help us? We could work together. And that really appealed to Pete. His name is Pete Meerberg, and he started working with this other group in what he called the humanitarian resistance. He actually didn't care that much for the mainstream resistance. He said those people had bayonets and they were doing sabotage, but I think the humanitarian resistance was much more important. So Pete was the politically minded one. For most of the others, it was either a pure call of the heart, which is why I call the book The Heart Has Reasons, where they saw these. For instance, there was a big razzia, a roundup of Jews in Amsterdam. And after the adults were taken away, there was a young woman, also a student, who saw a bunch of Jewish children just wandering the streets, not knowing where to go, that their parents had been taken away. And she just thought, this just can't happen. These children need somebody to take care of them. So she went over to them, and she led them right to the home of a friend of hers, because she knew that the mother of her friend had a big heart and would help with these children. And that was the beginning of the Utrecht student group, which is the one that Pete Meerberg wound up working with. In Utrecht, they just saw the need, their hearts responded, they took action, and they began to find homes for these Jewish children. After they'd found homes for the initial nine that had been wandering the streets, there were plenty more who needed to be helped. So, as you can hear, quite a few were students. There were also some very religious rescuers who felt it was their Christian duty to help. They felt that some of them were Calvinists, and they felt that this was just their duty as Protestants to resist tyranny, to stand up against injustice. And Holland has a history of that. In fact, if you read their national anthem, the words say, you know, we resisted King Philip of Spain when he tried to cram Catholicism down our throats. And so they plugged into that whole activism in their religion.
How important were organizations in rescue versus individuals?
Pretty important. There were some lone individuals who acted just unilaterally. They just made the decision and they did it, and they never got involved with anyone else. But much more often you had groups of like-minded people secretly finding each other and working together. And the Dutch are pretty good at organizing. That was both their strength and their weakness, as I said at the beginning. They tend to work in a very much like team players. So often it led to these groups rather than just sole individuals.
Were these groups associated with any organizations that existed previous to 1940, the invasion of Holland?
They were either student groups, which might have grown out of a kind of a student group that had been operating prior to the invasion, like just some kind of social club or group that might have been meeting. One guy, Kees Veenstra, was part of a nature group. It was kind of like the Boy Scouts, but it was run only by young people, and you had to resign when you were, after the age of 21, you were out. So you could join at 12 and stay till 21, and they'd go on nature trips and bird watching and all that. But then they became a rescuer group once their Jewish members became endangered. There were also a couple of religious groups that became rescuer groups.
The Calvinist groups?
The Calvinist groups, yeah. And Catholics were involved also.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Mark Klempner, the author of The Heart Has Reasons, Holocaust Rescuers and Their Stories of Courage, a book that looks at the people in Holland who helped to rescue Jews during World War II. The book focuses on 10 rescuers. He interviewed 40 individuals. Mark, we've been talking around the story, making some general statements. Occasionally you've gone into the individuals, but I'm really interested in hearing more of the stories of the individuals. You've brought some interview excerpts from your collection. I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about some of the central themes that come out of the interviews, maybe using some of the materials that you brought.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you say, the subtitle of the book is Holocaust Rescuers and Their Stories of Courage, and certainly courage was something that came out of many of these stories. Hetty Wouter was one of those students at in the Utrecht Kinder Committee, and she was incredibly brave, taking Jewish children on her bicycle, finding safe addresses. She was very gutsy, and she was just a no-nonsense, let's save these kids kind of young person. She tells one story of driving on her bicycle, riding on her bicycle past a farm, and she saw the farm was quite isolated. She thought, oh, this would be a good place to hide children. And she knocked on the door, and she didn't usually do this, but I think she kind of knew that this guy had been around a long time, and he showed no signs of being joining up with the Nazis. And she said, oh, you've got a nice farm out here, and it's so isolated. Would you consider taking in a few Jewish children? And he got very upset with her. How dare you ask me that? And she was irate, and she was saying, well, you know, if your farm burns down, you're going to want people to help put out the fire. But if everybody responded like you just did, then your barn will just burn to the ground. And she walked away, and She said, and don't expect me to help you either. She just was a real go-getter, and she was able to find many safe addresses, take the kids. But unfortunately, they got into a situation that turned out to be a bad situation. There was a house they had been using with a couple, and it was a wonderful place, very isolated, very safe. And then another house was offered to them, and they thought, oh, this could be really good, and they needed to find someone to live in the house and take care of the kids. And they found this couple who were willing to do it, and after a while, they'd sent them about 7 or 8 kids, and then they got a message out of Westerbork, which was the concentration camp in Holland. It was kind of a transit camp. People were sent from Westerbork to Auschwitz and other camps. They got a message that everyone involved with this particular couple from the resistance was betrayed. And they did a little research, and they found out that, sure enough, these people were clearly in cahoots with the Gestapo. So what to do? Well, they sat around, these students, all 20, 21 years old, and they said, well, we have to kill these people. They already have 9 of the children, and it's only could be any day when they turn them in. And this came after a housekeeper who they had also sent over to this couple. The housekeeper was Jewish, and she overheard them talking about when they were going to turn in the children. Should they wait for more, or should they do it now? So they decided to take matters into their own hands. This was the one story of violence perpetrated by the rescuers against the Nazis in the book. And they hired a gang, a paramilitary gang, that did this kind of thing, and sent them to the house along with a couple of the members of the Utrecht group. And unfortunately, as Hetty explained, everybody was rank amateurs, and the man was killed, the woman was wounded, and she went and called the Gestapo. Soon they were searching all over for poor Hetty and Gisela, her friend. Well, they caught them a couple of days later, and they threw them into jail, but the good thing was they threw them into jail together. And this became a fantastic story of friendship under the worst circumstances. Hetty and Gisela, two members of the Utrecht Kinder Committee, two friends who had helped save Jewish children, were now in jail together and commenced cheering each other up, giving each other support, emotional support. And they were such a great combo together that when they were transferred to Ravensbrück concentration camp, they began singing together, singing songs to cheer up the other inmates. They would sing in harmony. They would take familiar tunes like Lily Marlene, and they would help raise the morale of the other inmates. And one of the cuts I brought along today is Hetty and Gisela singing one of the songs. I should explain that this recording was made many years after the war, when they had a reunion of women who had been in Ravensbrück. Ravensbrück was, I believe, the only all-women's concentration camp. And the women got together many, many years later, and everybody asked Gisela and Hetty to sing for them again. And they did. It was a big hit. And then, due to popular demand, they got together with a piano player who also had spent time in a concentration camp. And he accompanied them, and they recorded all the songs that they used to sing in Ravensbrück, and they distributed the tape to their fellow former inmates. And Hetty was kind enough to give me a copy of the tape, and that's what we'll listen to now.
Onder de grijze dweilen rook een sigaret en je geklets daar heel tevreden.